York, this is Democracy Now!
Antitrust laws and strong antitrust laws are essential for freedom and for a thriving economy. The highly concentrated big tech marketplaces and the existing abuses of big tech enabled by their dominant positions poses a major democratic threat.
The Department of Justice and 11 states have filed a major antitrust lawsuit against Google in a move that could lead to its breakup. We'll speak to law professor Zephyr Teachout, author of Break 'em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. Plus, we'll speak with her about her call for Senate Democrats to use every procedural tool possible to block the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Then to Mexico.
It is an unequivocal example of the decomposition of the regime, of how the public service, the governmental body in the country, was degraded.
Former Mexican Defense Secretary General Salvador Cienfuegos has been ordered held without bail in the United States after his shocking arrest last week at Los Angeles International Airport for working with a major drug cartel while heading Mexico's military. We'll get the latest and look at what this means for victims of human rights massacres during his time in office. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin headlines with a story that includes graphic video of state violence. Security forces in Nigeria opened fire on protesters in Lagos Tuesday as authorities imposed a 24-hour curfew to stem growing demonstrations against police brutality. There are conflicting accounts of how many protesters were shot. Amnesty International said it had received, quote, credible but disturbing evidence that protesters had been killed. One Nigerian police officer told the New York Times 11 protesters had died. Dozens of protesters have also been hospitalized. Some witnesses posted videos on social media where rapid gunfire could be heard.
Please tell people. People are having to run. They're shooting at them at the Lekki toll gate. Please tell social media.
The killings in Nigeria come 2 weeks after protests began against a branch of the Nigerian police known as SARS. That's the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, which has long been accused of committing torture, murder and extortion. The killings on Tuesday sparked outrage from Nigerians across the globe. The soccer star, Odion Ighalo, who plays for Manchester United, posted this video online.
I'm not the kind of guy that talks about politics. But I can't keep quiet anymore for what is going on back home in Nigeria. I would say Nigerian government, you guys are a shame to the world for killing your own citizens, sending military to the streets to kill unarmed protesters because they are protesting for their rights. It's uncalled for.
Here in the United States, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden urged Nigerian authorities to, quote, cease the violent crackdown on protesters in Nigeria. The United States reported more than 60,000 new coronavirus cases and over 900 deaths Tuesday as a third surge of U.S. infections appears to set rival to previous peaks. On Tuesday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said the number of deaths from all causes across the U.S. so far this year is about 300,000 more than expected. 31 states now qualify as red zones under the White House Coronavirus Task Force's policies. In New Mexico, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham has ordered new restrictions on retail stores, restaurants and bars as a surge of COVID cases has left over 80% of adult hospital beds in New Mexico filled. Health officials have ordered students at the University of Michigan to quarantine in their homes and dormitories after off-campus parties were blamed for more than half of all new coronavirus cases in the city of Ann Arbor. On Tuesday, a House committee on the coronavirus crisis released White House reports revealing the Trump administration has been aware of an alarming nationwide rise in cases for over a month, even as President Trump publicly downplays the crisis, got sick with COVID-19, and held crowded campaign events that contributed to the spread of the disease. Coronavirus cases continue to surge across the European Union as colder weather drives people indoors and pandemic fatigue sets in. In Germany, some residents of Bavaria were ordered to shelter at home for 2 weeks in the nation's first new lockdown since April. Belgium's health ministers warning hospitals could soon be overrun by what he called a tsunami of COVID-19 patients. At the Vatican, Pope Francis wore a face mask throughout a public service Tuesday, the first time the pontiff has fully complied with Vatican City protocols that went into effect October 6th. In Latin America, Brazil's official COVID-19 death toll is approaching 155,000, while Argentina just recorded its 1 millionth coronavirus case, surpassing Spain as the world's fifth most affected country. Back in the United States, the Department of Justice has sued the internet giant Google in a massive antitrust lawsuit that will have major implications for the rest of big tech and could lead to Google's breakup. The DOJ complaint was joined by attorneys general in 11 states. It reads in part, quote, Google has used anti-competitive tactics to maintain and extend its monopolies in the markets for general search services, search advertising, and general search text advertising that cornerstones of its empire. We'll have more on the Google antitrust lawsuit after headlines. In immigration news, attorneys with the American Civil Liberties Union working to identify families that were separated at the U.S.-Mexico border say they have not been able to find the parents of 545 children in U.S. custody, as most of those parents have already been deported to Central America. NBC News reports the ACLU and other legal groups were appointed to help reunite children taken from their parents under a Trump administration 2017 zero-tolerance pilot program, which separated over 1,000 families. Only about half of them have been reunited. A number of the children, the government does not know their whereabouts either. An investigation by the Los Angeles Times has uncovered 265 calls to police reporting physical and sexual violence against asylum seekers inside California's four privately run immigration prisons, nearly all of which went unprosecuted. Half of those reports were cases of rape and sexual assault. The rest were reports of assault and battery. One case involves an asylum seeker from El Salvador who was beaten by an Immigration and Customs Enforcement deportation officer in 2018. After the agent threatened to, quote, F him up if the asylum seeker refused to sign paperwork. The asylum seeker says the agent then slammed him into a concrete wall. Altogether, only three cases of prisoner abuse were prosecuted. In Chicago, early voting got underway Saturday for hundreds of prisoners at the Cook County Jail. They're among 20,000 pretrial prisoners in Illinois, given access to absentee ballots and, in some cases, voting machines at jails.
So I'm able to voice my opinion and let everyone know that we're still human beings and it still counts. We still have to deal with the same things that everybody else have to deal with when it comes to society and living and our rights.
A recent report by the Sentencing Project found 5.2 million U.S. citizens are forbidden from voting due to laws that disenfranchise people with felony convictions. One out of 16 African Americans of voting age is disenfranchised. In Texas, a federal appeals court has ruled that election officials can void people's ballots if they determine a signature on the ballot cannot be verified. Under the court's ruling, officials don't have to inform voters that their ballots were rejected until after the election. In Minnesota, the Council on American-Islamic Relations is suing the private security company Atlas Aegis for recruiting ex-U.S. military special operations soldiers to deploy to polling places, calling it illegal voter intimidation and a breach of the Voting Rights Act. Michigan's Secretary of State is ordering a ban on the open carrying of firearms within 100 feet of polling places. In Florida, Miami's police department says it will discipline police officer Daniel Ubeda after he was photographed in uniform wearing a pro-Trump mask and holstered firearm outside a voting site. This all follows Donald Trump Jr.'s call for volunteers to deploy to Democratic precincts to, quote, join army for Trump's election security. Joe Biden's transition team is vetting several prominent Republicans for cabinet positions. Politico reports the candidates include former Ohio Governor John Kasich, corporate executive Meg Whitman, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, former Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, and former Pennsylvania Congressmember Charlie Dent, who's been working as a healthcare industry lobbyist since resigning from Congress in 2018. This comes as the New York Times reports the Biden campaign has raised almost $200 million from donors who gave at least $100,000. The campaign is also refusing to reveal the names of so-called bundlers who organize and collect checks from other major donors. President Trump campaigned in Pennsylvania Tuesday, where thousands of supporters ignored social distancing guidelines to pack a rally at Erie International Airport, where many were not wearing masks. First Lady Melania Trump was due to join the event, but remained at the White House. Her chief of staff said the First Lady has a lingering cough as she continues to recover from COVID-19. President Trump railed against 60 Minutes and its host Leslie Stahl Tuesday after he cut short an interview with the CBS News program at the White House. After the interview, Trump tweeted, quote, "For the sake of accuracy in reporting, I'm considering posting my interview with Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes prior to airtime. This will be done so that everybody can get a glimpse of what a fake and biased interview is all about," Trump quoted. Separately, on Tuesday, Trump ordered Attorney General William Barr to launch a probe of the Bidens over unverified claims of corruption tied to Hunter Biden's time spent on the board of a Ukrainian oil company. This is Trump speaking on Fox News Tuesday.
Will you be appointing a special prosecutor?
We've got to get the Attorney General to act. He's got to act. And he's got to act fast. He's got to appoint somebody. This is major corruption, and this has to be known about before the election.
The fiancé of the slain Washington Post columnist, Jamal Khashoggi, has filed a civil lawsuit in Washington, D.C. against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for ordering his torture and killing 2 years ago inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The lawsuit also names more than two dozen other Saudis who the lawsuit claims were part of a plot to, quote, permanently silence Khashoggi, who'd begun writing articles critical of the Saudi royal family. In Colombia, two leaders with the leftist political movement Colombia Humana were assassinated Tuesday in two different regions of Colombia. Eduardo Alarcón was reportedly shot to death at his home by assailants on a motorcycle, and Gustavo Herrera was fatally shot while out on the street. This comes as thousands of indigenous and other social leaders are planning a national strike in Bogota today, protesting against the government's social and economic policies and demanding the government of right-wing President Iván Duque end the violence and murders against social leaders in Colombia. In the Caribbean, environmentalists are warning of a looming oil disaster as a stricken tanker threatens to unleash a spill that could rival the 1989 Exxon Valdez catastrophe. Images of the ship show it listing drastically to starboard as it continues to take on water not far from Trinidad and Tobago. The Venezuelan flag tanker has 80 million gallons of oil on board. The ship has been idled in the Gulf of Paria since the Trump administration imposed an embargo on Venezuela's petroleum industry in January. In Kentucky, a member of the grand jury that heard evidence in the case of Breonna Taylor's killing says jurors were never given the opportunity to consider homicide charges against the Louisville police officers who shot Taylor to death as they served a no-knock warrant in Taylor's home last March. In a statement issued through their lawyer, the anonymous juror wrote, quote, "The grand jury didn't agree certain actions were justified, nor did it decide the indictment should be the only charges in the Breonna Taylor case. The grand jury was not given the opportunity to deliberate on those charges," unquote. The Associated Press has revealed Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett served for nearly 3 years on the board of a private Christian school which barred openly gay teachers and effectively barred admission to children of same-sex parents. Trinity Schools ran schools in Indiana, Minnesota, and Virginia. It's affiliated with the secretive religious group People of Praise, of which Barrett is a longtime member. The schools teach students that homosexuality is an abomination against God. The Senate Judiciary Committee has planning to vote on Barrett's confirmation Thursday, despite protests by Democrats who accuse Republicans of rushing her confirmation ahead of the election. We'll have more on that later in the show. And a new report looking into the presence of lead in tap water shows that of nearly 800 families from across the United States included in the study, most homes had detectable lead in their tap water, and at least 15% had levels of lead that could potentially cause a drop in the IQ of infants who are exclusively fed with formula mixed with tap water. The study also found Black babies are at a much higher risk of being exposed to lead in tap water. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the Department of Justice has sued the internet giant Google in a massive antitrust lawsuit that will have major implications for the rest of big tech and may even lead to Google's breakup. 11 states joined the lawsuit, the largest of its kind against a tech company in more than two decades. It accuses Google of engaging in illegal practices to maintain a monopoly on the market, including by spending billions of dollars each year on deals with Apple and other companies to appear as the default search engine on handheld devices and browsing services. Through these practices, Google, quote, owns or controls search distribution channels accounting for roughly 80% of the general search queries in the United States, according to the Department of Justice. The DOJ complaint reads in part, quote, the Google of today is a monopoly gatekeeper for the internet and one of the wealthiest companies on the planet. Google has used anti-competitive tactics to maintain and extend its monopolies in the markets for general search services, search advertising, and general search text advertising, the cornerstones of its empire, unquote. The complaint continues, quote, absent a court order, Google will continue executing its anti-competitive strategy, crippling the competitive process, reducing consumer choice, and stifling innovation, unquote. For more, we're joined by Zephyr Teachout, professor of law at Fordham University and author of the new book, Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech, and Big Money. Earlier this month, Professor Teachout testified at the Subcommittee on Antitrust, Commercial and Administrative Law Judiciary Committee investigation into competition in digital markets. Zephyr Teachout, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the significance of this lawsuit and what it means?
Thank you for having me. It is an incredibly important lawsuit, and it is clearly just the beginning of what should be a series of both lawsuits at the federal and state level. Keep your eyes on the states and legislation to deal with this incredible democratic crisis we have of big tech really becoming a form of private, for-profit government that is taking over so many parts of our lives. As you mentioned, it has been decades since we have seen an antitrust case of this kind, not just against big tech, but in general. The last big one, of course, was Microsoft. And as most people understand, the case against Microsoft was actually essential in leading to the innovations that followed in Silicon Valley. But in the last 10, 15 years, you've seen these big tech giants consolidating power and then protecting their power through illegal means. And what this complaint lays out is, you know, years and years of illegal practices of Google coming to not just dominate, but then illegally protect its monopoly in this area. And just being a person in the world, you know what a monopoly Google is, that search is an essential part of all of our lives. It's an essential gateway through which everybody has to pass. And I mean, this suit comes right after the major report by Cicilline, the House Antitrust Subcommittee report, which really took pretty direct aim at enforcers for their pathetic failure to do their job with existing antitrust laws, and called for Congress to act because of the nature of the democratic crisis we face.
And Zephyr Teachout, I wanted to ask you about some of the revelations in the complaint, specifically the close ties between some of these tech giants like Google and Apple. Because on one hand, Google is arguing that the default its use of its search as a default on Apple equipment is not a big deal because the user can switch it. But at the same time, it was revealed that spending $8 to $12 billion paying Apple $8 to $12 billion a year just to have Google's search be the default on all Apple equipment.
Yeah. No, this is a really important revelation. I mean, there's some aspects of this lawsuit where those of us who've been watching this field are saying this suit should have been brought a long time ago. A lot of Google's behavior is really obvious. It's obvious there's a monopoly, and it's obvious that it's been using its power in to maintain its monopoly, using its contractual power to do so. Looking at the relationship with Apple is really important, because here you have Google paying Apple. And I think it helps just clarify something that I argued in my book, which is that we are dealing with something akin to, you know, mafia power, where you have a handful of big companies that theoretically compete, but they're also supporting each other and growing their power, and they are effectively competing against democracy. It's an alternate form of governance. And so here you have Apple getting rich off of Google maintaining its monopoly. And what I think this points to is the importance of people understanding that this suit is the beginning and has to only be the beginning. The antitrust subcommittee, Cicilline's investigations, was absolutely revelatory. And this was a House committee with five staffers going up against these four big tech firms. And we learned about self-dealing behavior on Amazon's part, the way that Apple operates. And we have enforcers who've just been sitting on the sidelines for decades, kind of acting as if there's something magical about tech that they're acting in two ways. One is that there's something magical about tech, that if we actually enforce basic laws, then you can't have nice things. Tech will go away. In fact, all of history suggests the opposite, that antitrust is essential for innovation. And this is something the suit talks about. But it also shows just how deeply both, honestly, Democrats and Republicans have bought into this really dangerous idea that we don't have an anti-monopoly problem unless you can precisely point to consumer prices going up. But I want to talk about the harm here, because I think it's really important to understand how this relates to the moment we're living in.
I wanted to ask you, though, in terms of this issue of Democrats and Republicans, could you comment about the decision of Attorney General William Barr to bring this lawsuit just before the elections? Apparently, many of the lawyers who were working on this case felt that they were not yet ready. But for some reason, the Attorney General moved forward. And also that there was an investigation of Google back during the Obama years, where apparently some Obama-era justice officials felt that they should be moving forward in antitrust, but that didn't happen back then. Now, if you talk about how the Republican administration is dealing with the Trump administration now and how Obama dealt with it several years back.
I mean, we had a real revolving door problem with Obama and Google in particular, and a failure during the Obama years to bring antitrust cases, to be aggressive enforcers. And this is one of the things the Cicilline report really lays out, is this decades of non-enforcement. I do think it's important. Look, Barr should be impeached. He should have been impeached a while ago. He is lawless. He has undermined the rule of law. And I have been regularly calling for his impeachment and have zero respect there. But this is a pretty narrow slam dunk case. And I would be wary of understanding it in partisan terms. I want to point to the statement of Attorney General Tish James yesterday, a very powerful statement, which is clear that they are going forward with the Google investigation. And I'll actually be really interested to see if they even expand it beyond what this kind of pretty narrow but pretty central claim. I also want to say something that Amy mentioned that is really important to understand about this case. When we're talking about remedies, what do you do when you have a search engine which has become basically public infrastructure, but it's profit-seeking, data-mining, privacy-destroying, small business-crushing public infrastructure? What do you do? Well, the legal recourse we have under current law is to break it up. And that is not off the table in this suit. In fact, structural remedies, when you see structural remedies, that's code for breaking up, is mentioned in the lawsuit. But one of the things this moment, this lawsuit does is while it's going forward, it pushes the ball back to Congress. Because we may decide, you know, we want to have a search engine that we all share. We just shouldn't have it be profit-seeking, non-transparent, self-serving. We might want to then move to a public utility model where you can have a search engine, but the search engine doesn't rely on targeted ads and the sucking up of individual, personal, and by the way, political data in the way that it currently does. So this lawsuit sort of squarely puts Congress in the position to say, what kind of public communications infrastructure do we want to have?
Zephyr Teachout, Senior Vice President of Google Affairs, Kent Walker, responded to the lawsuit in an article titled, "A Deeply Flawed Lawsuit That Would Do Nothing to Help Consumers." In it, Walker writes, "People use Google because they choose to, not because they're forced to or because they can't find alternatives. This lawsuit would do nothing to help consumers. To the contrary, it would artificially prop up lower quality search alternatives, raise phone prices, and make it harder for people to get the search services they want to use." If you could respond to this and follow through on the earlier point you wanted to make about the real life harms that are done here.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is it's not a surprising press release. It's the same thing that Microsoft said in 98. It's basically what Standard Oil was saying. Look, people are choosing us, even though we are forcing our product on those with whom we contract with. But I do want to talk about the real life harms. What the complaint talks about is the harms to innovation, and that's quite real, and the harms to privacy. So if you have right now, if you are angry about what how Google is gathering up your data, if you're angry about the way that Google is basically, it's an ad company. We call it a search company, but it makes its money through the targeted ad business model. The recourse is to go beg Google to be better, and we know how well that goes. So when you actually have a competitive market with DuckDuckGo, which is or Bing or Yahoo, actually competing on grounds of saying, hey, we're going to protect your privacy better. We're going to do search in a way that isn't self-serving, isn't based on targeted ads. You actually lead to both more innovation and better consumer protection. The direct harm that the complaint doesn't talk about, though, is that because of Google's monopoly, it charges an enormous amount, outrageous amounts, to people who need to advertise on it. And that's when we're thinking about the small businesses who are currently struggling right now. And so those small businesses then having to pay more just to get seen, to get known, push that cost onto their workers. And there's recent research showing that the ways in which monopoly power is a major driver of inequality. And that's the thing that isn't in the suit, but we need to understand is when you have monopoly choke points at the center of our economy, they use that power to go suck value out of businesses who then turn around and push that harm onto workers.
I know you have to leave, but we wanted to get to part two of this conversation, and that's not about Google, but about Supreme Court Justice nominee Amy Coney Barrett. In today's headlines, we said that the Associated Press has revealed Supreme Court nominee Barrett served for nearly 3 years on the board of a private Christian school which barred openly gay teachers, effectively barred admission to children of same-sex parents. Trinity Schools run schools in Indiana, Minnesota, and Virginia, affiliated with the secret conservative religious group People of Praise, of which Barrett is a longtime member. That's just the latest news. The schools teach that homosexuality is abomination against God. You have urged Senate Democrats to use every procedure possible to block her confirmation. Why?
A Barrett confirmation is a catastrophe. We don't know a fraction about her. This is like getting married in 3 weeks, except it's not getting married. It's choosing somebody who's going to govern us effectively, decide the rules of our democracy, the rules governing our bodies, the rules governing our intimate relationships for 50 years. And we don't actually need to know that much to know that a 6-3 majority on the court is basically a bomb coming at what is left of our protections against corruption in politics, against corporate money, what is left of the Voting Rights Act. I mean, this is an absolute 5-10 alarm fire catastrophe. And the Democrats have not been, for instance, denying unanimous consent at every single vote, forcing McConnell to deliver every single senator, every single moment. There's techniques that have already, opportunities that have already passed. For instance, the Democrats could have had week by week continuing resolutions to keep the government going, forcing McConnell to produce his vulnerable senators. And there'll be moments coming up this Thursday. But what I hear from the Democrats is, well, that isn't sure to work or isn't likely to work. That is not the question. If there is a 1 in 500 chance that a 2-hour delay caused by impeachment, let alone a day delay caused by impeachment of Bill Barr, for instance, would lead to enough disruption that enough Republican senators would say, McConnell, you're asking too much. I'm not going to be there for you. Then we wouldn't be leading into this catastrophe. So I think we really need to see in these last few days, Democrats aligned on a very clear message about the whole of the altogether illegitimacy of this process and the catastrophic danger of this nomination.
And Zephyr Teachout, in the eventuality that she is confirmed, there's been increasing debate over what can be done to counter the court packing that has been going on now for several years on the part of the Republicans in the federal judiciary. I'm wondering your thoughts on this whole issue of expanding the Supreme Court if Joe Biden is elected and the Democrats gain control of both houses.
Well, I have been arguing for rebalancing the court for a long time, that we I think it is a small D democratic necessity. It's solidly constitutionally grounded. And after the court, Justice Roberts, in a grotesquely innovative, which is to say he made it up, theory struck down the Voting Rights Act. It became very clear that we needed a rebalancing of the court and a new understanding of this institution, as well as thinking about shorter terms for justices. I think that is absolutely necessary.
And finally, and I know you have to go, the Supreme Court decision that just came out around
yes.
voting rights. So the Supreme Court yeah. issuing a 4-4 ruling on a voting rights case in Pennsylvania. So significant because this was a victory for voting rights advocates. It shows the court is evenly divided on these issues. Of course, the election is going to be key. If Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, she would break that tie. The significance of this.
Both short and long term significance of this is extraordinary because this is about the court reviewing state constitutional decisions about what those local state constitutions require. And you have this very dangerous, radical perspective by four members of the Supreme Court, which Amy Barrett would join. Which would jump in and second guess those state constitution-based decisions, which have been important in allowing people's votes to be counted in this election. So we could see a Justice Barrett being a tiebreaker in suppressing votes in this upcoming election and changing the outcomes of the votes that are happening right now for the November 3rd election.
Why haven't Democrats pushed harder, do you think?
I am pulling my hair out about this. I'm sorry to be so, well, I'm not sorry to be so blunt about it. There is such a deep misunderstanding of risk and short-termism and failure to understand the scope of this catastrophe and complacency and sclerosis. And I think, well, you know, what I hear is people say things like that is not likely to work. Well, I will tell you, whether you talk to a serious death penalty lawyer defending their client on death row or a serious corporate lawyer defending against a corporate takeover, their answer to that question is if we've got a 1 in 100 chance, we are going to file that motion. And we just don't have that approach in the Senate or in the House.
Zephyr Teachout, we want to thank you so much for being with us, professor of law at Fordham University and author of the new book, Break 'Em Up, Recovering Our Freedom from Big Ag, Big Tech and Big Money. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a shocking arrest in Los Angeles Airport. The former Mexican defense chief, the defense secretary, will talk about the implications of this for the drug trade, as well as human rights abuses and murders of activists in Mexico. Stay with us. Alberta. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we spend the rest of the hour looking at Mexico as former Defense Secretary General Salvador Cienfuegos has been indicted in New York on charges of money laundering and conspiracy to distribute drugs in the U.S. from 2015 to 2017. General Cienfuegos is accused of working with the Beltran Leyva cartel to arrest and torture rivals in exchange for bribes. On Tuesday, a judge ordered Cienfuegos to be held in U.S. custody without bail, saying he is a flight risk. The judge also ordered the former defense secretary be sent to New York from Los Angeles, where he was arrested at L.A. International Airport last Thursday. Cienfuegos served as defense secretary from 2012 to 2018 under Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto. On Monday, the current Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said he would ask the U.S. to share all information about ties between the former defense secretary and cartels. General Salvador Cienfuegos has long been accused of human rights abuses in Mexico, including refusing to allow investigators to interview soldiers who may have been involved in the 2014 disappearance and likely massacre of 43 students from a teacher's college in Ayotzinapa, Guerrero, Mexico. Cienfuegos also defended soldiers who were accused of massacring nearly two dozen people in the town of Tlatlaya in the state of Mexico in 2014. For more, we're joined by two guests. Anabel Hernandez is with us. She's been described as one of the most courageous journalists in Mexico. In 2010, she published the groundbreaking book Narcoland, The Mexican Drug Lords and Their Godfathers, linking top Mexican governmental officials to the world's most powerful drug cartels. She received so many death threats that the National Human Rights Commission in Mexico assigned her 2 full-time bodyguards. Despite the danger, she's continued to report. Her most recent book, Traitor, The Secret Diary of Mao's son, about the son of one of the most powerful Mexican drug lords, Ismael Mao Zambada. Also with us, John Gibler, author and independent journalist based in Mexico. His book on the 2014 attacks against the Ayotzinapa students is called I Couldn't Even Imagine That They Would Kill Us. He's the author of To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War, and more recently, Torn from the World, A Guerrilla's Escape from a Secret Prison in Mexico. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Anabel Hernandez, we'll just say that you are somewhere in Europe right now. I mean, you face so much enormous personal threat for your work on exposing drug cartels in Mexico. Can you talk about the significance of the arrest of the former defense secretary of Mexico, Cienfuegos?
Good morning, Amy. Nice to hear you. Well, I really, what I can see is that the arrest of this general is not a case insulated. You have to see all the piece of all the picture. In this court was processed Joaquin Guzmán Loera, called El Chapo, one of the heads of the Sinaloa cartel in 2018. He was sentenced to life, imprisoned. Then this court, the same attorney general's office, ordered the arrest of Genaro García Luna, another former secretary of security, public security in Mexico in the period of the government of Felipe Calderón. And now you have this third very important arrest of the general. So if you see the picture, you can see like a maximum process against the corruption and the penetration of the drug traffickers inside the government. That's what I see, a maximum process that haven't ended yet. I think that now that Richard Donoghue and Michael Robotti, the two attorney generals head on these three cases, has a bigger picture about really how penetrated was the Mexican government in the last 18 years by the cartels. What I revealed in my book in 2010, Narcoland, and you know the story, all the threats that I received because I revealed this, that now is in this court, in this historic moment.
Well, Anabel Hernandez, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Genaro García Luna, who yes, not only was a top official under Felipe Calderón in terms of fighting drug, but also was a top law enforcement official under the previous president, Vicente Fox. These are people who the United States drug authorities, enforcement authorities, worked closely with over the years. And what does it say about the ability of the United States in terms of dealing with combating drugs in Mexico that these top officials worked closely with them? And now we're finding out they were a part of the problem.
For me, it's really a controversial question. For the U.S. government, of course, for the DEA, for the Department of Justice, how didn't they understand that these people were working for the drug cartels? I mean, the story of Genaro García Luna with the cartel, with the Sinaloa cartel, in complicity with the Sinaloa cartel and Los Beltrán-Leyva brothers, and the complicity also of Cienfuegos. Cienfuegos just doesn't start to do this in between 2015 and 2017. He started to protect the Sinaloa cartel and the Beltrán-Leyva brothers according with documents that I have, according with formal depositions of members of these cartels in front of the Attorney General Office in Mexico in 2010, in 2011, according with these depositions, General Cienfuegos was also protecting two Sinaloa cartel and Beltran Leyva brothers since 2005, also the government of Vicente Fox, when Cienfuegos was the head of the army in that region in Guerrero, and then in Mexico City, when these two parts were absolutely under control of the Sinaloa cartel and Beltran Leyva brothers. So, yes, the question is, if I, as a journalist, were able to discover on time that these two men, head of the government, were involved with the cartels, what happened with the DEA? What happened with other agencies that works in Mexico? They didn't saw it? They let them work? What happened? I think it's a question that until now is not a clear answer.
Yeah, and I think we have John Gibler also on with us, an independent journalist. I'm wondering if you could talk about the role of former defense minister Salvador Cienfuegos in terms of the massacre of Ayotzinapa and his legacy there.
Of course. Hi, Amy, Juan, Anabel. I hope everyone's doing well. Everyone's listening to us as well. Salvador Cienfuegos was, of course, the Secretary of Defense during the Peña Nieto administration, 2012-2018, and as such was chief of the army and chief of the so-called drug war during those years when several major massacres happened across Mexico. You mentioned the murder of 22 people in Tlatlaya, Mexico State, at the hands of army soldiers, as well as the murder of six people and the forced disappearance of 43 students from Ayotzinapa in late September 2014. Salvador Cienfuegos, like the other high-level federal officials, initially dismissed the importance of those events, immediately dissuaded any analysis of state participation, of military participation in those events, but also much later when the family members of the disappeared first, and then second, the human rights organizations and the independent international experts that arrived in Mexico also to assist the families in the investigation requested officially the ability to interview soldiers stationed in Iguala, Mexico, where most of the attacks took place on the night of September 26, 27, to just interview them about what happened, where they were, everything that happened that night. Salvador Cienfuegos himself, the head of the military, repeatedly refused to allow the families or their legal representatives and the independent experts access to the soldiers to interview them. Not only did he refuse that, but he went so far as to say that even talking to those soldiers would be criminalizing them. So now you have here a person who's being charged in New York of three counts of international drug trafficking and one count of money laundering, refusing to let parents looking, desperately looking for their children, forcibly disappeared by police in an operation carried out over hours, a mile and a half away from a major military base, refusing to let them speak to the soldiers, just speak to them, saying that that in itself would criminalize the soldiers.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion and also talk about another massacre, as well as what it means in the United States. Billions have gone to the drug war and have gone to the Mexican government. Who has pocketed that money? How many of them are now under arrest for drug trafficking themselves? Anabel Hernandez and John Gibler are our guests. Stay with us.
Pregunto por todas partes. Somos todos estudiantes. Ayotzinapa reunido. Pregunto por todas partes. Somos todos estudiantes, Ayotzinapa reunido. Ayotzinapa reunido.
Sinapa by Veronica Valerio. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk about the latest news, we're looking at Mexico, where last month authorities brought criminal charges against military soldiers for the first time in the ongoing investigation into the 2014 disappearance and likely massacre of 43 students from a teacher's college in Ayotzinapa, Guerrero, Mexico. Mexican officials announcing they had issued at least 25 arrest warrants against suspects believed to be the, quote, material and intellectual authors of the disappearance, including a former head of the federal police. Also, this past week, the former defense secretary of Mexico was arrested in Los Angeles airport. So we want to turn to families of the disappeared students who have long maintained the military was involved in the mass abduction. This is Clemente Rodriguez Moreno, the father of missing student Cristian Alfonso Rodriguez.
The previous government, led by Peña Nieto, said, "My little soldiers are untouchable." Colonel Cienfuegos said it. "No one can touch my troops." With this new government, we've managed to enter the military barracks, the 27th military barracks in Iguala. With this government, we've managed to do something we couldn't before. For example, the arrest of police officers.
For more, we continue with our two guests, journalist John Gibler and Anabel Hernandez. Anabel, if you could talk further about the human rights abuses in Mexico, the U.S. money that went into the so-called drug war, millions, if not billions of dollars, and not only the Ayotzinapa massacre of 2014, but as well another massacre that took place where 22 people were killed in the town of Tlatlaya in Mexico. And if you can relate this to the general who was just arrested.
Absolutely. As you remember, since the Plan Merida was signed between the U.S. government and Mexican government on 2008-2009, the cooperation, the collaboration between the U.S. government and Mexico were stronger, supposedly against the cartels. Now you see that part of the government was part of the cartels, but that was the story that they told to us. Then, of course, the General Cienfuegos, as I told you, has been always inside this system. He was one member of one very strong group in the Defense Secretary. Then, when Enrique Peña Nieto decide that Salvador Cienfuegos be the defense secretary, all these politics, all these decisions about the war against drugs cross under the order of Cienfuegos. So he was a key part of this war against drugs in the government of Enrique Peña Nieto. So with the pretext of this war, fake, as we can see very clearly, the army abuse of their power. They disappear many people, hundreds of people in Mexico. Since all this part of the time, I mean, since 2008, from 2020, we have been seeing how the army participate in massacres, disappear people, abuses of power, abuse of human rights, and all these things. So, with the pretext of the war against drugs. In one place of Mexico called Estado de Mexico, on July of 2014, the army massacre killed to 21 people, just like that. The official version was the supposedly was a combat between these supposed members of the cartel and the army, and all the members of the cartel were murdered. Just 2 days before the attack and disappearance of the students in Iguala, just 2 days before, the army, General Cienfuegos, have to confess, yes, we killed to that people. We're not a combat. We killed them. And start to be very, very uncomfortable for the government of Enrique Peña Nieto and for Cienfuegos in face this crime in Tlatlaya. Then when it happened in Iguala, when these students were attacked by the federal police, by the army, by the local police, the government of Enrique Peña Nieto, instead of reveal the truth about the case, instead investigate to the army, to the members of the army that participate, they cover up the crime. They create a fake story about what really happened that night. And that's why this is one of the reasons why until now these parents cannot hug again to their boys, to their children.
I wanted to ask John Gigler. John, could you talk about what President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has done since coming in office? He promised there would be no more impunity with the military. Last month, Mexican authorities issued dozens of arrest warrants for police and soldiers connected to the Ayotzinapa massacre or disappearances of the students. How has López Obrador dealt with this situation?
López Obrador made a very explicit commitment to the families. Actually, when he was still campaigning, the families confronted him during a campaign event in Iguala, Guerrero, and he made at that point a very explicit commitment to investigate the case, to find their children, to find the truth of what happened that night, and to do justice. And when he was elected, he reiterated his commitment. He formed a presidential commission to investigate the case. And then later, many months later, they named a special prosecutor who was someone who had actually worked with the independent experts earlier during the Peña Nieto administration, so someone who is intimately familiar with the details of the case. Since then, many of the families or the family members have said to me that while they believe in the commitment that the president has made, they feel inevitably the anguish of how long it's taking. But the new government has issued arrest warrants for several federal officials, including Tomás Herón de Lucio, who was the former police official supposedly in charge of investigating the attacks against the students, but who was one of the chief architects of the lie, the version that the government insisted on for several years, that the students had been confused for a rival cartel and taken out to this open-air outdoor trash dump in near a town of Cocula and incinerated there during a rainstorm over the course of a single night. Of course, that story was based on confessions that were extracted through torture. Several videos of those torture sessions have since come out, so it's become absolutely impossible to sustain the veracity of those confessions. But one thing that is important, that the new government is very clearly distancing itself from this previous administration's cover-ups or acts of administrative forced disappearance of the students for so many years. And in fact, the president, López Obrador, I think for the first time explicitly said that the attacks against the students had been a crime of state. The president articulated what had been for years the call of the families and of protesters in the street, fue el Estado. It was the state. It was a crime of state.
And finally, we just have 30 seconds, John, but how would you relate the U.S. funding of the drug war to the mass migration of Mexicans into the United States?
Very quickly, I mean, I think the U.S. drug war has and always been a racist and neo-imperialist tool. It's never been about controlling substances that are dangerous for communities. And the arrest of Cienfuegos is just one more example of how the highest level federal officials in charge of supposedly policing the drug industry are the ones actually administering it. This goes back all the way to the 90s with General Jesus Gutierrez Rebollo, Noé Ramírez Mandujano in the Calderón administration, of course, García Luna, and now Cienfuegos. The United States is obsessed with controlling and perpetuating this drug war, which wreaks terror on communities. Connecting it to migration, I was in the Central Valley, California. Migrants that are fleeing situations of terror that are provoked by the U.S. drug war.
We want to thank you both for being with us, John Gibler and Annabelle Hernandez. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask, vote.